seems to me, what I found to be, at least in my service, the most useful of all Srila Prabhupada's arguments against Mayavad philosophy. And I've given you three papers, all three of which were presented to scholarly, non-Krishna conscious audiences as an effort to explain the position of Krishna consciousness as being higher than Mayavad philosophy. And all three of them seem to have been pretty successful in achieving that aim. And I can take the same idea that's there, this idea that of karma, jnana, and bhakti as a dialectical spiritual progression. And I can go a lot further with it. I didn't realize what was the implications of this. Anyway, I started out with the one on deity worship and just used this to explain how we're not Mayavadis and to give a kind of plausible explanation of Krishna consciousness.
Do you have another order also?
This is a chronological order in which I wrote these things. This is the deity worship one, then the one that was in science and religion, and then the one on other religions. And then I started to realize some of the implications. And as you can see, I started to use it, this paradigm, to illustrate history, including modern European history, the relationship between the Enlightenment and the counter-Enlightenment and our present predicament. And I can go with it a whole lot of other places. So in academics, this is a good idea when you get an idea that you can milk for a long time and it keeps spinning out further papers and things like that. So today I just wanted to tell you where this idea came from, because it's not, although it's disguised in these paper to look like mental speculation, it actually comes from Srila Prabhupada. So I wanted to explain. If you see these little sheets here, oh, I forgot to bring my Isha Upanishad. It really comes from the Isha Upanishad. The Isha Upanishad is a book which is designed to take a Mayavadi and turn him into a bhakta. Huh? No, that's okay. I think I can wing it without it. No, why don't you go get it, actually? You have the translations here? That's enough. Actually, all I need is translations. I'm only want to deal with three mantras, 12, 13, and 14. And the Isha Upanishad is actually designed to take someone who's a Mayavadi and bring them up to the level of Krishna consciousness. It is dedicated to the Isha, to the Lord. It has those prayers in there that say, you know, your real face is covered by your dazzling effulgence, that is the Brahma Jyoti. Kindly remove that effulgence and exhibit your form of bliss, and so on. So the thing really takes place for me in this Isha Upanishad in mantras 12, 13, and 14. Mantra 12 states, those who are engaged in the worship of demigods enter into the darkest regions of ignorance, and still more so to the worshippers of the Absolute. Now, the current translation you have says impersonal Absolute. That was added later by Hayagriva. The original the original text, as Prabhupada published it, and that actually as it was published in America, just said Absolute. And, of course, it does mean the impersonal Absolute. But you lose the shock effect of the mantra. The mantra says that those who worship Asambhutim, relative and dependent beings, enter into darkness, and those who aim at the Absolute and independent being enters into an even greater darkness. See, that's what it says. It's heavy. Huh? Those who worship demigods go to hell, and those who worship the Absolute or aim at the absolute, go to an even darker hell. And then the next mantra, kind of, it's as though it registers an objection. How can that be? We've always heard from the authorities that one result's achieved by those who worship the demigods, and another result is achieved at those who aim at the absolute. Opposite results. One achieves birth and death in this material world, and one transcends birth and death. That's what we've heard. Now you're saying both of them go to hell. See? So then mantra 14, we get what is in effect the solution. That is the disclosure of what the real absolute is. One should know perfectly the Supreme Personality of Godhead and His transcendental name, as well as the temporary material creations and so on. In other words, you have to know Krishna and Krishna's energies, both together. Really, what you have, you see, there's one phase where they're involved with the world, the next phase where they reject the world and just worship an absolute with no energies, but the third phase, you have both in there, men, demigods, and you have the Lord of them both together. They're like synthesized, right? That's what it says. And the same word is used, Sambhutim, for the Supreme Personality of Godhead, as is used for the false absolute that you have there in the first mantra. Sambhutim. Or the impersonal absolute. So really, you have this progression here. You have one stage, those who worship the demigods, that is to say, Karmakanda. Then you have the rejection of that stage, Jnanakanda, who go into a darker region of ignorance. And then you have the final thing, which is bhakti. One should know perfectly well the personality of Godhead and His names, energies, and so on. In other words, that's the absolute in relationship to the world. Whereas the impersonal absolute, as we've discovered, has no world to relate to. You follow me? What this text is saying here? So, if in the first part of Mantra 12 you have the world, the second part you have the rejection of the world in favor of an absolute, and the third part you have the absolute and the world together. That is to say, Krishna and Krishna's energies. So, thesis, antithesis, synthesis. Those are the three traditional phases of a dialectical progression. We'll get into that later. So, here in the purport to Sri Yashupanishad, Prabhupada gives his critique of impersonal philosophy. He says, all philosophers and great rishis, or mystics, notice he translates that as mystics, just like we've been reading the great mystics, try to distinguish the absolute from the relative by their tiny brain power. And certainly we have seen some small but hyperactive brains at work. This can only help them reach the point of negating relativity without realizing any positive trace of the absolute. Right? And damn, if they don't all come to the same place. Whoever they are, they all end up there, you know, neti neti, the barren wastes, you know, the desert, the whatever it is. We have to use more modern metaphors, the empty parking lot of the Godhead. But, you know, they all end up, So he says, this can only help them reach the point of negating relativity, which is exactly what they do. If you look at Dionysius, he negates relativity over and over and over again. Definition of the absolute by negation is not complete. So notice here, this is idea of an incomplete process. He doesn't say it's wrong. He says it's incomplete. There's got to be more. Such negative definition leads one to create a concept of his own, Thus, one imagines that the Absolute must be formless and without qualities. If I say it has no forms, no material forms, and no qualities, then that leads me to a conception of the Absolute as being utterly without forms and qualities, right? Negative qualities are simply the reversals. Prabhupada originally wrote opposite numbers. This is a Hayagriva's editing. It was edited. Prabhupada originally published this in India. And then it was in his Back to Godhead magazine. And then it was published in America. And then then later it was re-edited. So, you know, I'm attached to the first American version. So anyway, he said reversals or opposite numbers are reversals of the positive qualities and are therefore also relative. By being reversals or opposite numbers, they're also relative. Is that a clear idea to everybody? Why it's also relative? Because it's related to that which it negates. Just like saying to somebody, don't think of a hippopotamus. You know, they have to think of the hippopotamus. So if you say not red, the first thing you think of is red. The negation is related to the... If the concept is not there to begin with, the negation has no meaning. So these are also relative. By conceiving of the Absolute in this way, one can at the utmost reach the impersonal effulgence of God known as Brahman, but he cannot make further progress to Bhagavan, the personality of Godhead. Well, there it is. I mean, in one short, sweet paragraph. This, to me, is the most decisive piece of argumentation that there ever is. It completely convinced me as a Mayavadi when I read Ishopanishad that Prabhupada was right. So this is his purport to Mantra 12, where he explains what's wrong with this absolute. So this is the definition by negation. Now somewhere along the line while I was studying this thing, I happened to recall at one time I had to study a little bit of this philosopher named Hegel, G.W.F. Hegel. And Hegel's idea is, briefly, is that history is the world spirit coming to full self-consciousness. God evolving into himself more and more, really. The absolute spirit through history is evolving and coming into higher and higher stages of his own consciousness. That ultimate stage, of course, is represented in the person of G.W.F. Hegel, when the absolute spirit looks back upon itself and reflects on its own history. But there's always this element of egocentricity in these fellows, huh? Anyway, that's his basic idea. And that history progresses by struggle and strife and overcoming. His paradigm of the ultimate historical event is the French Revolution. From that, he wants to deduce all of history. So anyway, he calls this struggle and overcoming a dialectic. And this dialectic has three phases. Now, this is added later. These terms aren't in Hegel, but they came in later. Thesis, antithesis. No, that's just antithesis. And synthesis. Where you start off with some state of affairs, and then there's a rebellion against it, and the negation of it. And these two enter into strife with each other. Then out of them, there's a synthesis, which retains elements of both, but brought up to a higher level. Then in Hegel, this synthesis then becomes the next thesis, and so things go on. Right? That's basically sort of how it works. Well, I can't give you a reason why this pattern happens to fit. I mean, karma, jnana, and bhakti fit this pattern. What that has to do with Hegel, I have no idea. You know, I'm not endorsing Hegel. I mean, I guess if I want to take this any further in an academic way, I'll have to get back into Hegel. Because obviously the man, you know, found a little truth somewhere and then tried to make something of it. And but I'm not, nor do I think that once you have attained bhakti, that then becomes, you know, the thesis for some other further development. So far as I know, this is it. So but I put it in these notes here. I just want to make it clear that this is not really about Hegel. And it's an interesting fact that these two things happen to fit. That this karma, jnana, bhakti development is described in the Isha Upanishad. It happens to fit this description of a dialectic progression. It's real interesting. But it's not important. You know, we don't want to get off into Hegel. So this we can call this a paradigm, right? A pattern, way of seeing things. And here in the back of the sheet, I've tried to outline again. All this appears in these articles again, but this this pattern. So you start off with the thesis, which we call the phase of karma. Now, all throughout these works, you know, that Prabhupada always, all throughout his works, he's talking about these, the culture of karma. That's what I call them, the culture of karma, the culture of jnana. Because they're forms of life. To quote an author almost everybody missed, knowledge depends on being. That's Kussler. He points out that these are forms of life. You're embedded in a certain culture. And from that you have an outlook. And from that outlook you see things in a certain way. And until you change your platform, you can't see what the other people see. Right? So this is the culture of karma, the culture of jnana, the culture of bhakti. And what I try to show, actually, through the course of these articles, is also this is a good way to use as a typology for understanding religions. And for understanding human culture in general. Because Prabhupada said this, that these are, you know, three ways of being that humans can be. They can engage in the culture of karma, they can engage in the culture of jnana, they can engage in the culture of bhakti. So what I've done through these historical examples and analysis of religion is just apply Prabhupada's statement and see how it works. You know, so one can make mistakes in that process, but the actual paradigm that comes from Srila Prabhupada, who gets it from the six Goswamis, who ultimately, well, it's there in the Isha Upanishad, among other places, very clearly. So here we have the ordinary world of relative things, huh? The world of sense gratification, the culture of karma, where, let's see, I think I gave it a capsule description in here. Denotes those rationally organized activities aimed at acquiring the good things of life for ourselves and those we identify with ourselves. Right? This is on page 22 of that first Back to Godhead handout. Thus we labor to gain secure and continuous possession and enjoyment of health and vitality, lands, goods, money, grace, charm, beauty, love, honor, repute, whatever, you know, this worldly. This is your ordinary human, you know, set life of sense gratification, of the senses. It's on the bottom, lower right-hand column on 22, karma. That's like a kind of generic definition of karma. But I say it's rationally organized. Usually there's a system for attaining these ends. There was Vedic sacrifice in the Vedic times. Today it's science or something else. So that's the generic phrase there. And then there's a rebellion against that. The turning away from the world in disgust. And this represents this phase of Gyan, of negation. So the movement from the thesis to the antithesis is one of negation and rebellion. And it's always been a fact, you know, that rebellion has always been characterized psychologically as an adolescent attitude, because rebels are always attached to that which they rebel against. If they didn't have something to rebel against, they would lose their identity. So it's a dependent form of existence. So this antithesis is dependent on this thesis on which it rebels. So then you get this jnana, this world-negating idea. So in karma, your object is to enjoy the senses. In jnana, you reject the senses. Remember Buddha? It's all miserable. Everything is miserable. Consciousness is miserable. Everything, whatever it is, it's miserable. Right? It goes on and on and on and on about how everything that arises is suffering. Birth is suffering. Death is suffering. This is suffering. That is suffering. It's all miserable. Right? So the jnana phase is a phase of world rejection, of rejecting the senses. And similarly, in the phase of karma, one uses the senses for sense gratification. That is to say, action goes on, you know, material action. But in the phase of jnana, all action is negated completely. No action whatsoever. In this phase, the world exists. It's all that there is. It's all that counts. It's all that's important is this world. When you get into jnana, it doesn't exist anymore. Completely denial, world denying. If this is world affirming, this is world denying. Right? Here in karma, the goal is to control cosmic processes. You want to gain control of everything so you can enjoy. Your sense gratification is impeded by the course of material nature, so your idea is to control it. And the karma mamamsa, as I discussed, their actual idea was that we can actually control the universe through sacrifice. It was pure technology. And that the gods, the mantras, had the power to force the gods to do everything. Krishna uses that philosophy when he's talking to Nanda Maharaj. That was karma mamamsa. They were pure technicians. They were just scientists, you know. So you want to gain control of the cosmic processes. Therefore, they're like modern science says there's no God because it wants to be able to hijack the universe. And if nobody's in the control house, it makes it a lot easier. So first you have to kill God. So you say, there's no one in control, so we can grab it. What do the engineers say? We can get a handle on it. They want to get a handle on the universe so they can ultimately get rid of birth, death, old age, and disease. This is the aim. Always aim at cosmic control. So if there's an idea of God or the gods, it's a very materialistic idea. They can come under our control. They're subject to defeat. There's something higher than them, like karma, and so on. A very materialistic idea of God. Or in modern times, it's just you don't have any idea. You just reject God whatsoever. So here in jnana, the whole idea is to, and you don't want to control the cosmic processes, you just want out. You just want freedom, you want liberation. You want material nature to stop acting on you. you want out. And then the Supreme just becomes characterized by no name, no form, simply by negation of everything. As opposed to the materialistic idea here, here you just deny everything. Now we can't have a material, here we had a materialistic idea of God, here we're going to just neti, 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 neti. Right, until we come down to the essential non-being, you know, of all. So that's how these two phrases are related like this. Right? So using the arguments that Prabhupada has, we can say this is incomplete. It's incomplete. You're trying to understand the absolute, and yet everything you do is dependent upon this. It's simply a negation. And we also can claim that we can point out that while, at least as far as in this phase, you're trying to understand the greatest, you've arrived at the idea of nothing at all. No name, no. How does that differ cognitively from nothing at all? Yet you're describing the greatest. And then the other thing we see in this mystical literature is an attempt that while they end up with zero, they want to say it ain't just simply zero. It's a something that's a nothing. Because then they start saying things like nirvana is samsara and samsara is nirvana. You know, they end up speaking very contradictorily like this. Which sounds to me like they're trying somehow or other to launch themselves off into something, you know, they cannot speak about. Why can't they speak about it? Because they're on this right here, you see, and their language is either affirmation or denial. One or the other. And if it's affirmation, it's of material. If it's denial, then they're talking about the spiritual realm, but they haven't got a hold of the thing itself. That's what Prabhupada is saying. They don't understand it. So look what happened. If the relationship between here and this is negation, according to the understanding of dialectic, the relationship between these two and this is called sublation. Sublation means that by coming to a higher platform, elements of the two preceding phrases are retained, but they're transformed. So that's actually what happens. That's actually what happens. You have, here in the phase of karma, the senses are enjoyed. The senses are used for enjoyment. Here, the senses are rejected. Here, the senses are used in Krishna's service. So here they're used, which is what goes on here, but they're rejected because they're not being used for sense gratification. The idea of using the senses in Krishna's service is a synthesis of both of these things. They're being used, but there's no sense enjoyment. From this point of view, what we're doing is impossible. It's logically impossible. It's a contradiction. But you can see, once you introduce the idea of Krishna into this, the senses and the sense objects, both. Let's talk about the sense objects. Here, the world is to be enjoyed. Here, the world is to be negated. Here, the world is neither to be enjoyed nor to be negated. It's to be used in Krishna's service. So that has this aspect of a synthesis. And you have both of these combined together. But they fit together because now you're on a higher platform. Is this clear? This is our philosophy. So the beauty of this is, you see, first of all, if you're talking to Western intellectuals, they're familiar with this kind of paradigm, at least most of them are. You know, so you're taking something that's unfamiliar and you fit into something they know. And then you take, you know, the highest, you know, what does he call it? The highest common factor. And you show it's not the highest common factor. There's something higher. There's something higher. Anyway, so the sense objects are used in Krishna's service. They're neither enjoyed nor rejected. Here, there's activity, material activity. Here, there's the rejection of all activity. And here, there's activity in the service of Krishna, or spiritual activity. Action, or what we call inaction, inaction. And when you use the Sanskrit word karma, the contradictory nature of this becomes really clear. Because it's action, it's karma, that produces no karma. So it's nishkarma karma. So we can speak, you know, just like Buddhists, like all say contradictory things, but actually it makes sense. There's no mystification. Simply, I'm acting for Krishna's service. Once you put Krishna in there, then you don't have to have all these, you know, elaborate paradoxes. Everything becomes very clear, very simple. We're serving Krishna. Action for Krishna. Here, they say the world is real and to be enjoyed. Here, the world is rejected. Here, we say it's real in relationship to Krishna. You see it the right way. If you see it separate from Krishna, it's unreal. And notice that both of these phases have this in common, is they actually see the world as separate from God. Both of them. They have some things in common. The common assumption is in both of these phases that name is material, form is material, quality is material. They share this common ground, these two phases. They share the common idea that a world not related to God.
Wouldn't you argue? Wouldn't someone argue that, say, someone who's praying for material things, to call with someone in the classification of karma, is not seeing the world separate from God?
Yeah, he's seeing God as he's seeing himself as the center. So God becomes an instrument for his enjoyment. If you think of God as an instrument for your enjoyment, you're really not thinking of God. You've got a materialistic idea of God, a fictional God. God, I mean, the real God, you know, he says, surrender to me. And if you're dealing with somebody you say as the supreme being, but that supreme being isn't saying, surrender to me, then that ain't the supreme being. That's your fiction. Yeah? Yeah. Mm-hmm. Well, we can hope that they'll gradually make progress.
In other words, that karma is a bit of bhakti.
Well, these get mixed. You know, there's karma. What that's advocating is karma, mishra bhakti, jnana, mishra bhakti. So you mix it a little bit. And that's the Vedic system. You do mix in, you know. But your idea of Vishnu is, you know, at least you're targeted in the right direction. But you don't really know who God is. You don't know who God is till you surrender. Anyway, that's how I'd argue that point. Usually what happens with people who are on this phase and see God as an instrument for their sense gratification, God exists or doesn't exist insofar as he satisfies my senses. You know? I mean, and you're thinking that God, well, maybe there is a God or maybe there isn't a God. I don't know. If you really understand what God is, you can't think maybe there is or maybe there isn't. God isn't the kind of being who just might or might not exist. That's the ontological argument. If you understand what God is, he exists without the possibility of not existing. That's the famous ontological argument. You know. Anyway, that's a side point. So here, then, when here, you know, if you think of God or gods, you think of them in a materialistic way. Here, you know, just by negation, names, form, qualities, nothing, 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 nothing. And here, transcendental name, transcendental form, transcendental qualities. So here you say that you had the idea of form or material form. Here, no form. And here you have, you know, the formless form, right? We can start talking like Buddhists. The formless form of Krishna. Because it's not a material form, yet he has transcendental form. So in this way, you have this progression like this. And it's really right there in the Isha Upanishad. As I said, why it should show up in Hegel, you know, that's another interesting question, but not really apropos. So just using this, as I said, the best way you can use it, then you can show that this, as Prabhupada said, the absolute defined by negation is incomplete. So here you complete you have to complete the process. And here all these paradoxes that people on this platform keep coming out with, but they're just mystifying. Here everything is explained very well. We can explain very easily what it means to act without acting. Yes, you just serve Krishna. And it's not exactly like they say, like this guy Stephen Mitchell, I quoted that in the exam. It's really classic, you know, what happens to the Tao Te King in modern hands too. What does he say? Practice not doing and everything will fall into place. It just falls into place. We practice not doing by serving the order of the spiritual master. We know that, you know, the mandate of heaven is there from Krishna. And we know it just doesn't fall into place. They have to like try to get detached and just hope everything falls into place. Nobody knows what they're doing. But here, what we say is, no, you know what Krishna's will is, and you serve his will, and then everything does fall into place. Anyway, this is the basic idea of this karma jnana bhakti typology. And then I found out by applying it in different ways, it seems to work pretty well. Well, let me point out that I didn't realize that until I was here going over Kussler. Not Kussler, Huxley. But he fits very well, right from as a person who goes from here to here. He comes from a family of scientists. He's very well educated in science. Then he becomes disgusted with the whole thing. He writes that book, Brave New World, about the anti-utopia, about the horrible future the world will be in when it's completely controlled by science. And then he says, no, knowledge depends upon being. And there's this other platform. And what does he use that word he uses all the time? It's empirical. It can be verified by people's experiences. He's completely on this platform. He's trying to get from here to here. You can see it, that rejection, that disgust with the material world, that frustration with the limits of knowledge or practice of science. And just as you can see why Buddha, you know, was objecting to sacrifice, the animal slaughter that was going on, everything like that, turning away from this against the priests. Just like today, so many people now in the Greens or the New Age movement, anti-scientists, anti-technology, and at the same time, it's all one. So the whole culture, you know, is a big chunk of the culture keeps trying to, as actually I argue in here, what the Western culture has been doing for a couple of centuries is oscillating back and forth between these two. That they can't make any practice, any progress, because they're trying jnana without vairagya. So they can't even get a foothold on the platform of jnana. Because you see everywhere, it's jnana vairagya, there's a compound. You don't really get a foothold in jnana unless you renounced sense enjoyment. They can't. There's no regulation. At least in the Vedic process of karma, it was regulated sense gratification. Now it's actually vikarma. There's no regulated sense gratification, so when they try to get up here, then they start to use really perverted things, you know, drugs and other things, because they can't become renounced enough. And you get the whole Western culture oscillating back and forth. Because as I point out in the article, this culture of karma came out in such a big way in what they call the Enlightenment.
Aufklärung,
you know, in the 18th century. And there was immediately this counter-enlightenment. All these ideas of the hippie movement are there in the early part of Romanticism. You know, it's all one, going back to early myths and getting into them, love of nature, nature worship. It was all there.
What century was it?
18th century, yeah. And then the Romantic movement. I think I put in this Back to Godhead magazine a little sidebar about the Enlightenment and the counter-enlightenment. It's probably in the second,
second.
Yeah, give a little historical background.
That's part two?
Yeah. So this counter-enlightenment had all these things, you know, emphasizing feeling over abstract thinking, sympathetic participation over detached observation, inspiration over analytical reasoning. So they were into nature as holistic, monism. You know, he had all these philosophies. Hegel's a romantic philosopher. You know, Wadsworth, you know, the universe is one big organism. So all these things that pop up in the 60s as part of the hippie movement, they were all there already. So what you had, huh? William Blake, he was early, but he was a forerunner of Romanticism, sure. He was a contemporary of the French Enlightenment more, but he hated it. He was already a counter-enlightenment sort of a person. So everything so you have these right now, what I call the culture of karma in the form of, you know, material science. And these guys are really pushing on. And then you have, you know, the Greens and the New Age people sort of in the culture of Gan. But they can't get anywhere. They've been fighting back and forth with each other. And they can't get anywhere. There's no... They can't come out anywhere. So that's why I suggest in this paper that, you know, the only thing that's going to solve things is if bhakti comes in, you know, from the outside, as it has to. Because you can't... speculate. You could. This is speculation. Okay, we'll call this philosophical speculation. And this says yes, the ultimate truth has to be a person. But it'd be frustrating if I just got to that point and I didn't know who that person was. Because still, you end up with pretty abstract conclusions. You don't know his name is Krishna. You don't know his girlfriend's name is Radharani. You don't know his home is Vrindavan. You don't know his skin is dark blue and beautiful. You don't know he wears a peacock feather. I mean, it could be anything, right? It could be an ostrich plume. It could be a sparrow. You know? Why cows? Why not sheep? Goats, you know? Why cows? Because that's just the way he is, you know? And there's no way you can deduce any of that stuff. So it's very hard if you don't. But if the revelation is there coming from the outside, then you can engage in bhakti. That's why you know, if you're going up, if you're trying to understand the absolute by your tiny brain power, you know, there's like a wall you can't get past here. But if Krishna gives a revelation, then it comes. Yeah.
Once you get to that point, then you have to start understanding basic principles of devotion, because people will say, this is terribly unscientific, you know, that God's blue and He lives in this fantastic place with thousands of times. All the other two are more or less based in an empirical understanding.
Yeah, that's right. That's right.
So once you get to that point, then it gets pretty hard. In one sense, we are arguing from a
Well, all you can say from a scientific point of view is this is here. It's here, right? Now, if you actually want to come to this platform, you have to change your culture. We can also say it's experience. But if you want to see Krishna, you have to, just as Huxley says, you know, you have to be detached and so these things to have this experience. So we say to have this experience, you have to have purified senses. Here the senses are dirty, they're engaged in sense gratification, so they're polluted. Here the senses are rejected. Here the senses are purified. Pure, we accept the senses, yet they're not engaged in sense gratification. What are their purified senses? When you have purified instruments through serving Krishna, then everything becomes revealed. Atasi Krishna Namadi Nabhavidgrayam Indriya. Your materially contaminated senses can't apprehend, comprehend, grasp, graya, the nature of Krishna's name, form, qualities. Because that'll be the question. That'll be the question. Well, when you say spiritual form, what does that mean? When you say Krishna is a spiritual blue, how does that differ from the color of Graham's jacket? You know, when they say, Prabhupada, what does Krishna look like? They say, just like this. Well, I mean, that's, you know, that's like, you know, I see that color everywhere. You know, how does it differ? So you have to have the senses to see. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
It's the wrong instrument.
Yeah.
It's the wrong, your material senses. When you look into transcendence with material senses, you know what you see? You draw a blank. There's no, nothing registers on your instruments, and that's when you say zero. That's a report on your ignorance, not a report as what's there. This is called the reification of ignorance. It's like those maps of you know, 16th century maps of America, where you get a little bit west and the mountains disappear, the rivers disappear, you know, on the map, and it's just flat. And you think that you actually walk, you know, a little past Ohio, the mountains are going to disappear, the rivers are going to disappear, and it's just going to be a flat, featureless expanse. You've taken a report on ignorance, which is in the map, and then laid it onto the real thing. So similarly, when you look into transcendence with your material senses, you're going to draw a blind. You're going to see nothing. And then you're going to say, nothing is there, except there's nothing with a capital N.
The thing is, people are going to want some transitional or some means to move from this to...
From jnana to bhakti?
Yeah, some empirical method.
The empirical method is you have to start engaging your senses in the service of Krishna. Take, here's a set of beads, and it begins with the tongue, jivado. It begins with the tongue, you eat Krishna prasadam, and you start chanting the Hare Krishna mantra, and tell us what happens in 2 weeks. You make an experiment. Just as Huxley says, you know, Huxley says make an experiment. A psychological and moral experiment. So this is a psychological and moral experiment. And most of us started chanting as a psychological and moral experiment. We were not yet convinced it was true. We just were going to see what happened. And then it became so hellish when we stopped, we had no choice but to keep going. Yeah?
Actually, I know a girl that was going to the University of Montreal. She wasn't. Told her she would do all those things just to prove that it made a difference.
Mm-hmm.
But actually, that's exactly what happened.
She
actually said, okay, I'll do this
and this.
You know, just to show you guys that
uh-huh.
it all means nothing.
Uh-huh. Just see. I'm glad that's how it turned out. Any other questions? Yeah? Well, it's kind of it's understanding what the Absolute is not. It has no material name, has no material form, has no... We agree. When they say no name, form, qualities, relationships, attributes, activities, if by name you mean material name, by form you mean material form, we agree. It's true, but it's incomplete. But as I said before, to them, the idea of a form that's not a material, the premise is all form is material form, all name is material name. That's why we say they're still materialistically contaminated. Because of that premise. Our idea, it's just like this. I met a businessman once. I was out shopping, you know, for the deities. And there was this old Jewish businessman, a very battered man, very, very cynical. You know, and he said to me, because I was, you can see I was a devotee, he says, you want to know my philosophy of life? he says, my philosophy of life is people stink. With such conviction, you know. And I can see he's probably been through a couple of horrendous divorces. You know, his partners cheated him and then turned around and sued him. I mean, I'm sure he had quite a story to tell, you know, about how people stink. And I'm sure he didn't look like he liked himself very much either. Now, how am I going to tell him God is a person? You know, if by definition people stink, what are you going to say about God as a person? No, 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 you know, not a big stinker. See, when people get rooted in these ideas, you know, or the same thing about their own identity. Just like the karmis always say, you know, oh, he's got such an ego. He's got an ego. It's like a bad thing just to have an ego. Because to them, ego means false ego. All their affairs, everything is nasty. And so when they imagine any of that stuff going on in transcendence, you know, they don't want to have anything to do with it. They just want freedom. Relationships, let me loose. All I want to do is get free from relationships. Every relationship I got into has just caused me nothing but pain and suffering. So what are you talking about relationships for? You know, it's this incredible experience of misery in the material world, and then want to throw it all out. Here's Prabhupada's example about a man who's sick, and everything he does is suffering. And the doctor says, well, when you're well, you know, you'll be able to walk, you'll be able to eat. He says, oh, walking, eating, I don't want anything to do with these things. Well, the other example Prabhupada uses, these are always good for preaching. That's the one example, the sick man. The second example is the example of the sweet rice. As you go to the Krishna temple for the first time and some cook has made a horrendous mistake and sand has ended up in the sweet rice, more likely to happen in India than the West, but... And so, you know, that silky, smooth taste of sweet rice. And I go, well, it's the first time you've been to a Krishna temple, you know. Everything here is strange. You figure, this must be the way it's supposed to be, you know. So you kind of very politely pretend nothing is happening. And the next time you come to the temple, somebody says, have some sweet rice. Says, oh, no, thanks. I tried that last time. I don't want any more. You reject it because your own experience is the experience of the contaminated thing. You reject the thing in its pure state. You imagine that condition of contamination has to carry over. Right? So these are two practical examples that Prabhupada uses to show why people reject transcendental name, form, activities, and so on. And you just got to understand, the more you think about it, you realize how miserable people are. Have to be in the material world to think this is a great thing. I mean, the amount of human suffering it testifies to is immense. You had something to say?
Yeah, there's a very vivid purport. Bhagavad Gita, chapter 4, text 10.
Yeah, that's right. Attachment, fear, and anger. Right. Prabhupada talks about the three, Krishna says, the three things that stop you are attachment to material existence, fear of an individual personal identity, and anger, frustration out of all kinds of anger arising out of frustration, at all kinds of speculations that don't seem certain. That's about fear, yeah.
Can we categorize actually everyone under the Gyan category as Mayavadi?
Well, of one sort or another, yeah. Are you thinking of somebody who might not be?
I was thinking about the karma getting back to my other,
You have got to understand that people do mix these two up together a lot, you know. Like Swami Lakshmi Devi in the Poconos used to send us her things all the time. Enjoy, but in a spirit of renunciation. That was her slogan. Yeah, everybody, and that's what happens because they can't, they don't have the vairagya. Their thing is to somehow or other, and that's how these people read this Tao Te Ching. You get in there, enjoy, but you're not attached. Just try it. You know, it doesn't work.
So in the karma category, there's not just one singular thing. For example, again, that materialistic person who believes in God, although you're saying not really.
Yeah.
They stand on as straight out atheist.
Yeah, there's different categories in this jnana thing too. You see them mixed up in people quite a bit. You know, so you have to kind of sort it out what platform they're on. You know, a lot of times they're in the middle of karma and longing for jnana, you know. A lot of times they're in jnana and falling back into karma. You know, there's a lot of back and forth. Okay, glorious Prabhupada.